and Indigenous peoples' history of the United States has been long in writing. I've been working on it for 7 years. It's a part of Beacon Press's Revisioning American History series that was inspired by Howard Zinn's, the late Howard Zinn's classic, A People's History of the United States. But the people, let's give a hand to Howard Zinn. The peoples in my title has the possessive apostrophe after the S to refer to the more than 500 Native American nations and communities in North America, the part of it that is now occupied by the United States. I'm going to read from chapter 10. It's titled The Ghost Dance Prophecy, A Nation is Coming. And I want to dedicate this reading to Lakota Hardin and Janine Antoine, who keep the heart of Native America beating in the Bay Area. Two great Lakota women. And I thank them for being there on KPFA, getting the word out, and for sponsoring, you know, and helping organize this event. Where's Janine? Where's Janine? Janine, stand up. Where's Janine? Is she here?
Yeah, she's here.
Yeah, there's Janine. The whole world is coming. A nation is coming. A nation is coming. The eagle has brought the message to the tribe. That's from a Lakota ghost dance song. And from Wallace Black Elk in 1973, Little Wounded Knee is turned into a giant world. So the first part of this I call the New Frontier. 70 years after the Wounded Knee Massacre, when the conquest of the continent was said to have been complete, and with Hawaii and Alaska made into states, rounding out the 50 stars on today's flag, the myth of an exceptional U.S.-American people destined to bring order out of chaos, to stimulate economic growth, and to replace savagery with civilization, not just in North America but throughout the world, proved to have enormous staying power. A key to John F. Kennedy's political success was that he revived the frontier as a trope of populist imperialism, openly based on the drama and popular myth of settling the continent, of, quote, taming a different sort of, quote, wilderness. In Kennedy's acceptance speech at the 1960 Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, historian Richard Slotkin writes, the presidential nominee asked his audience to see him as a new kind of frontiersman, confronting a different sort of wilderness. Kennedy said, I stand tonight facing west on what was once the last frontier. From the lands that stretched 3,000 miles behind me, the pioneers of old gave up their safety, their comfort, and sometimes their lives to build a new world here in the west. We stand today on the edge of the new frontier, a frontier of unknown opportunities and paths, a frontier of unfulfilled hopes and threats, unquote. Kennedy's use of the new frontier to encapsulate his campaign echoed debates about U.S. history that had begun more than six decades earlier. In 1894, historian Frederick Jackson Turner had presented the history-making frontier thesis, as he called it, claiming that the crisis of that era was the result of the closing of the frontier, and that a new frontier was needed to fill the ideological and spiritual vacuum created by the completion of settler colonialism. The so-called Turner thesis served as a dominant school of history of the U.S. West through most of the 20th century. The frontier metaphor described Kennedy's plan for employing political power to make the world the new frontier of the United States. Central to this vision was the Cold War, what Slotkin calls, quote, a heroic engagement in the long twilight struggle against communism, to which the nation was summoned, as Kennedy characterized it in his inaugural address. Soon after he took office, that struggle took the form of counterinsurgency programs in Vietnam. Quote, 7 years after Kennedy's nomination, American troops would be describing Vietnam as Indian country and search and destroy missions as a game of cowboys and Indians. And Kennedy's ambassador to Vietnam would justify a massive military escalation by citing the necessity of moving, quote, the Indians away from the, quote, fort so that the, quote, settlers could plant, quote, corn, an invention of the native people's corn. The movement of indigenous peoples to undo what generations of frontier expansionists had wrought continued during the Vietnam War era and won some major victories, but more importantly, a shift in consensus, will, and vision towards self-determination and land restitution, which prevails today. Activist efforts to end termination and secure restoration of land, particularly sacred sites, included Taos Pueblo's 64-year-old struggle with the U.S. government to reclaim their sacred Blue Lake in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains of New Mexico. In the first land restitution to any indigenous nation, President Richard M. Nixon signed into effect Public Law 91-550 on December 15, 1970, which had been approved with bipartisan majorities in Congress. I can tell you this would not have happened without the seizure and keeping Alcatraz for 18 months. Just ended. President Nixon stated, "This is a bill that represents justice because in 1906 an injustice was done in which the land involved in this bill, 48,000 acres, was taken from the Taos Pueblo Indians. The Congress of the United States now returns that land to whom it belongs." In hearings held in the preceding years by the Senate Subcommittee on Indian Affairs, members expressed fear of establishing a precedent of awarding land based on ancient use treaties or Aboriginal ownership rather than monetary payment. As one witness testifying in opposition to the return of Taos land said, quote, "The history of the land squabbles in New Mexico among various groups of people, including Indian Americans and Spanish Americans, is well known. Substantially every acre of our public domain, be it national forests, state parks, or wilderness areas, is threatened by claims from various groups who say they have some ancestral right to the land to the exclusion of all other persons, which can only be fostered and encouraged by the present legislation if passed." Although the Senate subcommittee members finally agreed to the Taos claim by satisfying themselves that it was unique, it did in fact set a precedent. The return of Blue Lake as a sacred site begs the question of whether other indigenous sacred sites remaining as national or state parks or as U.S. Forest Service or Bureau of Land Management lands and waterways should be returned. Administration of the Grand Canyon National Park has been partially restored to its ancestral caretakers. The Havasupai Nation, but other federal lands have not. A few sites, such as the volcanic El Malpai, a sacred site for the Pueblo Indians, have been designated as national monuments by executive order rather than restored as indigenous sacred territory. But the most prominent struggle has been the Lakota Sioux's attempt to restore the Pahasapa, or the Black Hills, where the odious Mount Rushmore carvings have scarred the sacred site. Called the Shrine of Democracy by the federal government, it is anything but that. Rather, it is a shrine of in-your-face illegal occupation and colonialism. The return of House Blue Lake was not a gift from above. In addition to the six-decade struggle of the Taos Pueblo, the restitution took place in the middle of renewed, powerful, and growing Native American struggle for self-determination. The movement's energy was evident when 26 young Native activists and students founded the National Indian Youth Council, NIYC, in 1961, based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. From 21 different Native nations, some from reservations or small towns, and others from relocated families far from home. The founders included Gloria Emerson and Herb Blatchford, both Diné, Navajo, Clyde Warrior, Ponca from Oklahoma, Mel Tom, Paiute from Nevada, and Shirley Hill Witt, Mohawk. Cherokee anthropologist Robert K. Thomas mentored the militant young activists. Although primarily committed to local struggles, their vision was international. As Shirley Hill Witt put it, at a time when new nations all over the globe are emerging from colonial control, their right to choose their own course places a vast burden of responsibility upon the most powerful nations to honor and protect those rights. The Indians of the United States may well present the test case of American liberalism. In 1964, the NIYC organized support for the ongoing indigenous struggle to protect treaty-guaranteed fishing rights in Washington state. Actor Marlon Brando took an interest and provided financial support and publicity. The fish-in is interesting because it was civil rights era and there were sit-ins. And Native people being out, you know, rural areas, how did they do a sit-in? Well, they did a fish-in, and then they did a wounded knee sit-in a few years later, and an Alcatraz sit-in. So it took a very different form, you know, characteristically of land-based peoples. So the fish-in movement soon put the tiny community at Frank's Landing in the headlines. Sid Mills was arrested there on October 13, 1968. Eloquently, he explained his actions. I am a Yakima and Cherokee Indian and a man. For 2 years and 4 months, I've been a soldier in the United States Army. I served in combat in Vietnam until critically wounded. I hereby renounce further obligation in service or duty to the United States Army. My first obligation now lies with the Indian people fighting for the lawful treaty to fish in usual and accustomed waters of Nisqually, Columbia, and other rivers of the Pacific Northwest, and in serving them in this fight in any way possible. He goes on, just 3 years ago today, on October 13, 1965, 19 women and children were brutalized by more than 45 armed agents of the state of Washington at Frank's Landing on the Nisqually River in a vicious, unwarranted attack. Interestingly, the oldest human skeleton remains ever found in the Western Hemisphere were recently uncovered on the banks of the Columbia River, the remains of Indian fishermen. What kind of government or society would spend millions of dollars to pick up our bones, restore our ancestral life patterns, and protect our ancient remains from damage, while at the same time eating upon the flesh of our living people? We will fight for our rights. Hank Adams, with other local leaders, founded the Survival for American Indians Association, which was composed of the Squamish, the Nisqually, Yakima, Paiute, the Stillaguamish, and other indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest to carry on the fishing rights struggle. The backlash from Anglo sports fishers was swift and violent, but in 1973, 14 of the fishing nations sued Washington State in court. And in a reflection of changed times, the following year, after Wounded Knee, U.S. District Court Judge George Bolt found in their favor. He validated their right to 50% of fish taken in the usual and accustomed places that were designated in the 1850s treaties, even where those places were not under tribal control. This was a landmark decision for historical indigenous sovereignty over territories outside of designated reservation boundaries. The National Indian Youth Council saw itself as an engine for igniting local organizing, marshaling community organizing projects with access to funds from the Johnson administration, war on poverty, the mandate of which was to implement the principles of economic and social equality intended by authors of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Inter-ethnic alliances, including a significant representation of Native peoples, developed during the mid-1960s. These culminated in the 1968 Poor People's Campaign, spearheaded by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., which consisted of community organizing and leading marches across the country. In the final months of the campaign planning, Dr. King was assassinated on April 4, 1968. Thousands of marchers arrived in Washington, D.C. in the next month and gathered in a tent city, Resurrection City, that remained there for 6 weeks. While local actions multiplied in Native communities and nations, the spectacular November 1969 seizure, November 20th, soon the 45th anniversary is coming, and the 18-month occupation of Alcatraz Island in the San Francisco Bay grabbed wide media attention. An alliance known as the Indians of All Tribes was initiated by Native American students and community members living in the Bay Area. They built a thriving village on the island that drew Native pilgrimages from all over the continent, radicalizing thousands, especially Native youth. Indigenous women leaders were particularly impressive, among them Madonna Thunderhawk, Lenata Means, Warjack, Reina Ramirez, and many others who continued organizing into the 21st century. The proclamation of the Indians of All Tribes expressed the level of indigenous solidarity. We, the Native Americans, reclaim the land known as Alcatraz Island in the name of all of American Indians by right of discovery. So, a little. So there was a lot of humor also in the satire. So despite this, you know, riff on the history of U.S. colonialism, the group made serious demands for 5 institutions to be established on Alcatraz. And why don't we have them yet? A Center for Native American Studies, an American Indian Spiritual Center, an Indian Center of Ecology that would do scientific research on reversing pollution of water and air. This is, you know, like 45 years ago. A great Indian training school that would run a restaurant, provide job training, market indigenous arts, and teach the, quote, noble and tragic events of Indian history, including the Trail of Tears and the Massacre of Wounded Knee, and a memorial, a reminder that the island had been established as a prison initially to incarcerate and execute California Indian resistors to U.S. assault on their nations. And in fact, the first imprisoned were actually Hopi families who refused to allow the federal government to take their children off to federal boarding schools. Under orders of the Nixon White House, the indigenous residents remained on Alcatraz until they were forced to evacuate in June 1971. Indigenous professors Jack Forbes and David Risling, who were in the process of establishing Native American Studies programs at the University of California, Davis, negotiated a grant from the federal government of unused land near Davis, where the institutions demanded by Alcatraz occupants could be established. A two-year Native American Chicano College and Movement Center, DQ University, was founded, while UC Davis became the first U.S. university to offer a doctorate in Native American Studies, a very prestigious degree now, these days.